Clerk will call the docket.
Gene D. Callis, you have James D. Blick, substitute trustee at Al, William E. Schmidheiser III, for the appellant, David A. Penrod, Kevin N. Rose, John C. Wirtz, Jessica L. Robinson, John I. Hill, the appellees.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, Bill Schmidheiser, representing the appellant, Gene Callison. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Your Honors, the power and the beauty and the majesty of our system of justice, inherited from the English system, is that courts are not constrained merely to apply the narrow technical legal solution to a case, but are allowed to, indeed mandated to, apply equities to fill in the interstices between what the law or maybe the bare naked words of a contract may provide. I cited in the in my brief the Rosenbaum case, which is an old case, an 1898 case, that talks about equitable subordination and talks about the rule of equity applying equitable subordination in circumstances where the agreement of the parties or the circumstances of the case require.
Counsel, the history you cite also includes something about the role of the decision maker, and the equitable history that we've inherited places great weight on the discretion of the chancellor. And we sit not technically as chancellors today, but reviewing a chancellor, and the equities which you pled and presented were considered. They're rather complex, but they appear to have been thoroughly considered. It didn't turn out to be the equitable result you sought, but can you tell us where the boundary is? How can we say that this chancellor abused the pretty vast discretion that the equitable precedent gives him?
Yes, sir. It is not an unconstrained discretion. The judge is not entitled to ignore what actually happened in this case. It appears that what the trial court did in this case was to say there's nothing in the exact legal words of the contract between the parties that subordinates the claim of Trainum against Callison to the claim of Callison against Trainum, because there's nothing in the naked legal words of the contract. I can't find that. I cannot find that she is subordinated in equity.
But is there anything illogical about that? Because he can't start the analysis without a default principle, an opening assumption. And equity follows the law, but equity can go beyond the law. So if we start with the law, we start with the presumption these are co-sureties, not sub-surety, that the sub-surety is not in existence, only a co-surety is. And equity has to move him off of that base, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And that is why if you look at both the restatement of sureties 145, the good thing about this case is the parties agree as to what is the applicable law. The judge agreed with what was the applicable law, which was the application of the restatement of sureties 145 to this, whether under the agreement of the parties or the circumstances of the case, equity requires subordination. The agreement of the parties is more than, must be, under the language of that and Rosenbaum, must be more than just the contract. I think the error of the trial court was to say that I don't see a document that says the claim of Gene Callison is subordinated to the claim of Trainum or vice versa, therefore I can't do that. The agreement of parties must be more than just the words of the contract, but encompasses what was, as we say, the agreement of the parties. Let me give you an example from this case. The parties entered into an option agreement that had a lease, had an option. The option was locked in 2011 at $550,000. At that time, the parties agreed that's what the property was worth before we make improvements. The agreement of the parties was that ET Investments, owned by Trainum and Elliott, would then borrow $500,000. There is nothing in the documents that says that $500,000 is going to be used for improvements to then Mr. Callison, later Mrs. Callison's property. Nevertheless, that was the agreement of the parties. The agreement of the parties must mean more than just the documents, else you wouldn't need equity. You would just say, well, it says right here there's a subordination. The doctrine that allows for equitable subordination says the agreement of the parties is that which amplifies and makes sense out of the contract, not to contradict the contract. You cannot do that in equity, even if you'd like to. I was accused in one of these briefs of, quote, playing the widow card. I am proud to represent Jean Callison, and yes, she is an elderly widow, but that's not why I'm asking this court to reverse the decision of the trial court, but rather because the trial court abused its discretion, made pretty much an egregious error. The consequence of that, if left, is that Mr. Trainum is the holder of the note, is the guarantor of the note, is the owner of the maker of the note, is causing the maker of the note to withhold payment on the obligation to himself in order to foreclose on Jean Callison's property. The consequence of the judge exercising what I would say in error, abusing his discretion and saying nothing I can do about that, is that her property will be sold to pay off the debt to Mr. Trainum with no recourse to
Mr.
Trainum.
Could she not have disclaimed this property in the inheritance? Could she not have avoided all of this just by not receiving the property through the inheritance?
That would not make sense, Your Honor. Why, at that time, she had property that had there was substantial value in the property. We had property that in 2011 the parties agreed was worth $550,000. And then in 2011, $500,000, and then in 2012, an additional $100,000 was put into the property for improvements.
I realize it doesn't make sense, but it depends on your assumptions. If you assumed the Chancellor's decision in this case, it would have made a lot of sense. Am I right?
Then the Chancellor's decision makes no sense.
Okay, well then one of the two is wrong. The Chancellor is wrong, or your client was wrong.
Correct, and the Chancellor was wrong. And let me explain why that is the case, sir. In April 2012, we have a deed of trust by agreement of Mrs. Callison. She agreed that a deed of trust would be placed for the benefit of Frontier Community Bank on her property in the amount of $600,000 to secure the note of ET Investments, owned by Mr. Trainum and Mr. Elliott, to Frontier Community Bank.
Right, and so at the time that she could have made the decision on the disclaimer, she knew about the burdens of the lease and the deed of trust, right?
Burdens and the benefits. At that time, presumably, we had property that was worth $550,000 plus $600,000 of improvements. The appellee's argument and the result that is constrained by the trial court is that immediately after closing that loan, $600,000 loan, they could have enforced the $550,000 option, forced Mr. Callison to pay off their loan to Frontier Community Bank with no recourse. That is, they could exercise an option for $550,000 to purchase property on which they had just borrowed $600,000, and they would then have the benefit of property worth $1,150,000, presumably, and pay zero for it, having her pay off their loan.
But the
is not the agreement of the
parties. The intervening fact, though, is this was going along swimmingly to everyone's mutual profit until the dealership went bankrupt. And so then, you know, your opponents had a steady stream of income that was paying off the note, and that's now gone. So I think your argument would have more force if from the very beginning they had immediately exercised the option, discharged the note, and that would just event some kind of, you know, bad faith and so on. But here, the rug got pulled out from under everybody, and so isn't this just a, you know, forces overtook what was originally a mutually beneficial deal through really nobody's fault?
As I said, Section 145, Restatement, says either by equitable subordination arises either by agreement of the parties or by circumstances occurring subsequent. Looking at the agreement of the parties, it cannot be that the agreement of the parties in totality was that Callison's property would be obligated to pay off the loan of ET Investments with no recourse. That cannot be what the agreement of the parties was. The agreement of the parties means more than the naked language of the contract. That's otherwise you wouldn't need equity.
But, you know, so from the standpoint
if
of...
If I may, Your Honor, right. I apologize. But then you talked about the rug being pulled out from under the parties. Who pulled the rug? Mr. Trainum pulled the rug.
But there's more than that, though, right? Because they're getting $4,000-plus in reliable rents, and then the dealership goes belly up. Now, the record shows he owns other properties that are being used for retail and office space and so on. But, you know, he did lose a major tenant that was supplying a lot of income. So then if the question is, do I go under or do I exercise this contractual right and somebody else takes a hit? Well, the natural reaction for most folks is going to be, well, rather than me sustain the pain, somebody else is going to get it.
All right. I understand and agree. That was the natural reaction. And the nice thing is, if you look at the brief of Mr. Trainum, he actually admits in it, my goal was to sell Mrs. Callison's property to satisfy my debt to me. Okay? And the question is, in equity, in law, there may be nothing to prevent it, but in equity, doesn't it make sense that if you have a loan that his company borrowed, that he's the guarantor on, that he got the benefit of, that if Mrs. Callison's property is sold to pay off his debt, merely because, and now that he owns it, that she should be equitably subordinated to his claim, and that she has a right to recover from him the money that is sold, that comes from her property, to pay off Mr. Trainum's debt now to himself, especially when, I say under the original agreement of the parties, that would be the, but then he makes it worse because he has a note which is current. He buys the note from Frontier Community Bank. At that time, the note is current. There is automatic debit making the payment on the $600,000 note every month. Mr. Trainum acknowledges, I terminated that automatic debit to create a default at a time when ET Investments had money in the bank to pay that note, at a time when ET Investments had 5,000 shares in Frontier Community Bank that it could have sold, at a time when ET Investments had other assets that it could have used to make those payments, at a time when other companies owned by Trainum and Elliott owed money to ET Investments. But he acknowledged in court, I made no effort.
The line drawing difficulty is that, you know, there's, you have the law of the marketplace, which can be pretty harsh. And people, you know, invest in good investments, bad investments. The good ones fructify great. The bad ones go south, and you just take the hit. So at what point do we say equity really has to intervene as a matter of discretion, as opposed to, well, it's just a deal that didn't work out the way people anticipated, and so that's just too bad? Because you can see the problem if we start putting the judicial thumb on the scale for every bad deal and say it's inequitable, you know, have all kinds of problems, you know, for the smooth functioning of the market.
It wasn't a bad deal, though, Your Honor. It wasn't a bad deal until Mr. Trainum intentionally made it a bad deal.
But the intentionally making it a bad deal is that a personal guarantor simply turned around and bought the note to control the foreclosure process. That's not intrinsically bad faith. That's within his legal rights. That's an assumption that was not made when your client re-upped the deed of trust and entered into the process of receiving the benefits of the bargain temporarily. So, you know, it seems to me to circle back to the question of whether or not a chancellor could look at these facts and say, on balance, I have to stay with the default principle, which the restatement confirms. We start with the idea of co-suretyship.
Your Honor, I'm not doing my job if I'm not helping you understand the number of things that Mr. Trainum did, not to simply enforce the obligation, but to make it worse, to make the situation worse. And one of the basic principles is that a surety is relieved when somebody is actively doing things to make the obligation worse. Mr. Trainum was not only the owner of the company that owed the money, the person that benefited from the loan, the guarantor of the loan, but he was actively causing the obligor, ET Investments, to not make payments on the note. He was in control of the obligor of the note, and he did things to make it worse. That's more than just enforcing his rights under the note as a note holder. If Frontier Community Bank were seeking to foreclose and nothing had been done by it to make things worse, that would be a different case. But here we have a person who is taking numerous steps to make it worse, and only for the purpose of forcing her to pay his debt. My time is up.
It's Kevin Ruse. May it please the court, it's Kevin Ruse. I represent Appalee David Trainum. I'm going to take 10 minutes, and we've got two other counsel that represent other Appalees. One's going to have 3 minutes, the other's going to have 2 minutes. So give the heads up. This is a convoluted transaction. I would imagine that I can't see anything in 200 years plus of looking at case law that see anything like it. I didn't find anything like it in Virginia or any other state.
Is there a single fact that you disagree with that was just stated to us?
That he stated? Yeah, a lot of them. Like, for example, well, obviously the stuff that he's saying was inequitable. My client did.
No, the facts.
No, the facts.
Just the facts. Is there a single fact where you disagree with what he just said?
I guess I can't remember every fact he said. I think it's the spin he puts on some of these facts that I have a problem with. And I think generally if the court maybe had a better background to understand what went on here.
We've read the briefs. Do we need to read anything else?
Excuse me?
We've read the briefs. Do we need anything else to get the background?
Probably, to me, when I look at this, because there's so much to it, the thing that's probably the most helpful to understand why I think this attack on my client, he's such a bad guy, is if you look deeper into the transaction and say, well, why did Mr. Trainum do these things? And I think one thing that's getting lost is the fact that Mr. Trainum, all he's doing is cutting losses. He's not making money. The implication that Mr. Schmidheiser would suggest is that somehow my client benefits from all this or whatever. And that's not the way it's going to go down. When the property is sold and the lien's paid off, money will come to him, but he had to borrow, take another note out to get the note. And the irony is that the bank still holds the note as collateral. So he's not going to make any money. All the money is going to flow to the bank. One fact he did mention is about Mr. Trainum having the ability, having all this money and the ability to continue paying the note, did these things intentionally to cause the default on the note. And in reality, what happened is when all these dealerships go down and ET Investments has multiple notes with the bank, as the evidence showed, there was five different loans out there that the bank's counsel, when Mr. Trainum decided to buy the one note, the bank's counsel insisted you had to buy all five. And so there are other properties. So not only did this property in question, did he lose a tenant, he lost tenants on his other properties. So basically what he's done is he had to go out and take an interest-only note that allows him to basically stay afloat because he's lost his rental source to make these. So this is a bigger problem than just this one Callison note.
One fact, and perhaps I misunderstood opposing counsel to say that your client was actively causing the obligor to not make the payments. Do you agree with
that? I disagree with that.
Tell me why.
Because I think this information is in the record, in the transcript. The money that he's got or whatever is available, he's got five notes he's got to pay. And just because there may be money that's in the in those accounts, he has to use those up not just to pay this specific note in question. He has to use it to pay all five notes because he took another note out. So what my client did is once he takes another note out and combines all five notes, he now has to write an interest-only check to the bank. So he's writing that note, but the other note is not getting, you know, I guess indirectly is getting paid because of the other note. So it's not a matter of he's intentionally choosing not to pay this one note in question. What he's doing is he's taking the remainder of what assets he has or cash that he has, and he had to use that to make the interest-only payments on the note he acquired to get all five notes.
You have a footnote in your brief suggesting the bank's counsel signed off on the transaction for the five notes, in fact, insisted upon the other four notes to be added. Sticking only to the record before us, can you expand that briefly?
The bank's counsel is Mr. Schmidheiser. Mr. Schmidheiser recommended when my client went and said, okay, I want to buy this note, oh no, you've got to buy all five notes. And yet the bank held the collateral, and I think that's an important issue in this case.
So let me make sure I'm not misunderstanding what you just said and what your footnote says. So the bank's counsel literally signed off on the very transaction that gave Mr. Trainum the capacity to cut his losses as he did.
Yes. They allowed it by replacing five notes. He basically buys those five notes with another note that was interest only.
So he and wanted to buy just the one note, but the bank insisted upon the extra four.
Right.
Am I accurately hearing the facts?
That's correct, and that's in the record, and there's those in one of the exhibits is all five of those notes. And if you look, there's an assignment, and he makes it clear that the bank took an assignment held collateral the notes. So the bank actually, and the bank's not a party to this case. That's the one thing I think gets lost in all this. If Mr. Schmidheiser had his way, the actual party that suffers here would be the bank. Because the bank, you know, if there's not enough money to keep flowing it back down, they hold the note and basically effectively hold the collateral on the Callison property. Because when the sale occurs, that money, even though it may go to my client because the note is being held as collateral by the bank, that money is never going to touch my client's hands. It's going to all go straight to the bank to pay off the underlying note that they originally had.
But your client gets the property.
No, no.
He'll own the property at that point in time.
No, no, he won't. That's Mr. Bowles exercised the option. That's happily Mark Bowles. My client, Mr. Trainum, he didn't want this property. He had three or four other properties that had car dealerships in them that don't have car dealerships anymore. He's got no rent. The last thing he wanted was another piece of property that he didn't have a tenant for.
There's a sense that your client solicited Mr. Bowles to buy the note. Is that correct?
That's
that there is this grand sort of manipulation going on by your client.
That's what I call some sort of conspiracy theory that's kind of underlying that Mr. Schmidheiser suggests at different times. And as my client tried to explain, I can't remember. This gets into some of the stuff I talked about in my brief, where some of this was in deposition testimony, but then they didn't actually bring it up and ask the questions in court, so then it really never may have been addressed. But the bottom line is, my client didn't want the property because, for the reasons I just said, he's got, when Mr. Elliott walked away and said, you can have ET Investments, well, thanks a lot. I've got ET Investments, and it's got all these dealership properties that no longer have a car dealership in them, and I've got no source of rent, yet I need to make, not only do I need to make payments on the Callison note, I've got to make payments on this note and this note and this note and this note, and I don't have tenants in them. I mean, why would he want a fifth one? So he didn't want to buy that piece of property. He wanted to get sold and at least get rid of one of the notes, and he wanted to control that process and try to get involved in it to have it sold and at least get rid of one of the five notes and stop having to service that debt. So that's basically how that went.
He's trying to either not go under or at least minimize his losses is the bottom line for him.
That's all he's been doing. He suggest that he's going to come out of hit on it, he's getting crushed. I mean, between legal fees, I mean, he's keeping this afloat now. I mean, Mr. Schmidheiser will talk about, oh, he had this money out there. Right now, he's having to pump his own money in to pay all these notes because he's got no rent, and they've ran out, there's no cash flow, so he just has to keep, every day that goes by, until he gets some of these properties sold, he's just losing money every day because he's, there's no source. And so, there's his suggestion that my client somehow intentionally did all this or whatever because somehow he benefits is nothing further from the truth. This is a situation where a guarantor is scrambling to try to not take all the hit here and is trying to spread the loss amongst everybody. And the more interesting case to me is probably the next one. And that is because there's undoubtedly going to be follow-up cases on contributions, subrogation claims, whatever. To me, when I look at this case, what's really interesting, to me there's no doubt that posting collateral would make that person, I would say the collateral itself would be a subsidiary to the guarantors. In most transactions like this, the property is sold and the guarantors end up, responsible for the deficiency. It's almost always that the subsurety in that situation is the collateral. What's interesting here is we had a piece of property with other improvements on it. You add 600,000 improvements. Is just those 600,000 improvements a subsurety to the guarantors, and is then the balance a co-surety, or is it a subsurety to the guarantors? Because, you know, Ms. Callison, or and Mr. Callison before her, posted all of the property, which is kind of like a guarantee, not just the improvements themselves. But to me, under equitable principles, there can be no doubt that the actual collateral itself cannot be be in a situation where the guarantors are underneath it, must pay first, because it creates the windfall situation I explained in my brief. I mean, and I just think it would open up, you know, a Pandora's box of problems in the transactional world if you were to treat collateral that somehow it gets a preference position over guarantors and didn't force the sale. We all know it goes the other way typically. So anyway, I see I've got about 10 seconds left, so you know, I have questions on this.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, my name is John Wirth. I'm with Nelson McPherson, Summers & Santos in Stanton. I'm here on behalf of William J. Elliott IV. To clarify what the court ordered in this case was that upon Mr. Bowles' payment of the full option price, Ms. Callison must convey the property to him free and clear of any encumbrances. To avoid that eventuality, Ms. Callison asked this court to take an action which, as far as we can tell in our research, the court has never taken. That is to impose a subsuretyship. And to impose that subsuretyship not based upon an agreement of the parties, not based upon any documents that the parties signed agreeing to that subsuretyship, but rather upon equitable principles, upon the equities. And we heard a significant argument here today from Mr. Schmidheiser and in the his briefs about what sort of actions were taken. And he continues to point time and time and time again to Mr. Trainum. He argues that these actions were underhanded, were inequitable, were unfair. The point that I would like to make in the short period of time I have here today is that none of those allegations relate to actions by Mr. Elliott. And it would be inequitable and unfair and unjust and irrational then to impose upon Mr. Elliott a penalty for actions which allegedly were taken by Mr. Trainum. Yet that is exactly what Ms. Callison would have the court do. In her amended complaint, she asks that Mr. Trainum and Mr. Elliott be treated as primary sureties and that she be treated as a subsurety. So she would take Mr. Elliott from a position in which, arguably at least, he would be a co-surety with two other people to a position where he would be a co-surety with just one other person. It is not equitable to take a situation in which actions were allegedly undertaken by Mr. Trainum and then penalize Mr. Elliott for that.
Is it your position that she is a co-surety?
Your Honor, that is likely the case. We took that position in the court below. I think that there are certain uncertainties about that position, and I would follow what was said by my co-counsel in that respect, or rather, counsel for Mr. Trainum. The property itself, perhaps, is a co-surety. It is interesting to note that in the deed of trust, Mr. Callison agreed to be responsible, agreed that for the full payment of all of the debt, and in the modification agreement, that deed of trust is incorporated. And so I do believe that under those circumstances, at least, that they would be treated at least as a guarantor of the debt in the same fashion as Mr. Elliott and Mr. Trainum are, and would be co-sureties.
Thank you. All right, your time has expired.
Thank you, Judge.
May it please the Court, my name is John Hill. I represent the appellee, Mark D. Bowles. And Mr. Bowles may be the only party of this transaction who may turn out to make some money, and that's, I say, may, because his property stood vacant now for a number of years, and he holds the option for the $550,000. which, as he stated under oath in the trial court, he is ready to proceed with the purchase of. He is the defendant in one case and the plaintiff in another case. There has not been much argued here today or in the briefs about his position as the plaintiff in the case where he brought an action for specific performance against Ms. Callison to have her conform to the terms of the option contained in the lease. As this court has already stated here this morning, that your duty is not to reform or abrogate contracts without absent any fraud or undue influence or incapacity or mistake. Bad deals are not unfair deals. And this is a deal that has been bad for almost everyone but my client. And as you all have stated already, this deal was premised on an assumption that turned out to be true, and that is that a car dealership, a holder of a franchise of cars, would go under. And I don't think that any of the parties ever thought in their minds when they were creating these agreements that that would be the case. But that was the case. And unfortunately, the parties are going to lose money. But that does not mean that my client, the contractual agreements between my client and Ms. Callison, are any less valid. And that we would urge this court to affirm the ruling of the Chancellor.
Counselor, do you see a reason or do you not see a reason for the court to address the implications of the trial court's ruling upon potential future litigation?
I do. I think that if this court was to overturn the trial court, you're talking about potential litigation in this case or in other cases?
In these cases.
I'm not sure how that affects my client. My client is basically going to be the one that funds paying off a loan, which will then generate future litigation between these parties as to their relationship as potential co-sureties and subrogation.
So you're, from your perspective, for your particular client, there's really not that much interest. As far as you can tell, it won't affect you.
No, it will not. Thank you.
Did the trial court retain jurisdiction in the Bowles versus Callison case?
It did. I mean, as far as enforcing the contract, I'm not sure I understand the question from the court.
I seem to recall reading that the trial court had retained jurisdiction in the Bowles versus Callison.
It did, to enforce the terms of the contract. The order stated that the contract, the option was in place and was valid, and the court would have retained jurisdiction had Ms. Callison not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, your time expired. Call the next case.